下。
Hey, 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 welcome again to Taking It Down. A little later, if you listen to us when we actually release, we're a little later today. If this is your first listen, well, come on in. We're welcoming. But we are the pop culture podcast for the Alabama Take, and I'm the editor-in-chief there and the host for the podcast. My name's Blaine Duncan. We have a few items we're going to cover today, but some of the big items on the ticket are, I'm going to talk about Hamilton, okay? I'm going to put that out there. Just a trigger warning for some of you. I'm going to dive into my thoughts. If you've been hiding under a rock, the play was released with its original cast on Disney Plus last Friday. It's just in time for the 4th of July, which we've just recovered from. We'll talk briefly about the HBO series Perry Mason, and then later on we're going to have some fun dissecting this new documentary that's available for you to rent online called Jasper Maul, made by Alabama filmmakers, which we'll get into. Joining me today, of course, is co-host, contributor, musician, friend, Adam Morrow.
Good to be back.
There
on a
he
Tuesday.
Is.
On a Tuesday, we're talking. This is we've never been on a Tuesday, have we?
Nope. We never pushed this far back on a Tuesday on day of release, and had some power outages at the home office yesterday. So
just terrible timing. You said you saw them kind of working their way down the street. And when they got to you, I mean, I was sitting, I had my coffee, was perfect temperature, sat down, put my headphones on, that phone rattled, our power's out.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are, 24 hours later, that's all right.
The good company here in town decided to replace our pole, all for a good cause, but just a bad day to do it for me. But it's okay. We're here. We're going to get it. We're going to get it in your ears. Is this coming at you probably late Tuesday evening, maybe even Tuesday night, so that's fine. Let's get into some of the podcast. What do you think COVID's up to today?
Jamming somewhere. Just jamming. I assume that you're referring to the Jay-Z gif that I think I've sent about 800 times, where he's got his glasses on and he's kind of in the background and he's just grooving, you know? I got to think COVID is kind of looking at our culturally how we're dealing with this and just thinking, yeah, man, cool.
It's a living virus that it feeds on us, and yeah, it's just like, this is America is where it's at, man.
Who knew? I guess we all knew. If you had to predict it, this is kind of what I thought would happen. You know,
if you didn't know the specifics and just said how's America going to dissolve, and I told you a really uninformed leader paired with a disease no one's taking seriously. Did that sound feasible 6 years ago?
I don't know, because, you know, you want to believe that we're always getting a little bit better, even if, say, with a particular president or political moment, there's a little bit of a backslide. So 6 years ago, I may have optimistically believed that, but I, you know, we're just backsliding the hell out of the situation.
Okay, let's say December 2016.
Oh yeah, for sure.
If I would have said
absolutely,
if I would have told you, man, this coming president doesn't know anything about government, really, and there's a pandemic on the horizon, what would you have done?
I mean, what else could I do? You know, I can only Google how to immigrate to England so many times.
Teaching jobs in Canada.
Yeah.
Is a phrase I have said before. The personification of COVID as that Jay-Z gif is exactly the joke I'm making. Every time I think about COVID-19 now, I kind of see Jay-Z in the back of my head just like, yeah.
Grooving. Grooving.
COVID's having a year, man.
A pretty good year. Pretty good year. It ain't over yet.
In all seriousness.
I like how, like, 3 months ago we're like very somber tones about COVID, and now it's just like, obviously I'm still wearing my mask everywhere, I'm washing the hell out of my hands, I'm not really hanging out with people, but no. it's just pushed to the point of absurdism at this point.
It's totally absurd, and that's why it brings me to laughter on some days. But yeah, I'm still taking it seriously, absolutely. And if you have it, you know, we're not making a lot of you, we're making a lot of idiots' responses about it, so, because it doesn't seem to be fruitful. It doesn't seem to be headed in the right direction. Okay. Anyway, our jokes are out of the way, sort of. Let's talk briefly, maybe a couple of quick thoughts on the HBO show I May Destroy You. Are you caught up on this one?
I'm fully caught up. One of the joys of doing this on Tuesday, taping on Tuesday, I caught last night's episode.
As did I. Yeah, I did too. The last night's episode, this week's episode, was episode 5, and I feel like episode 4 is where the show 100% revealed itself, because sometimes I can be blind to a show's theme. I can just be sucked in and just enjoying the plot points, but I feel like this one really showed its hand in episode 4, and it is a pretty scary concept to me, done really adept.
What are you saying is the main theme that you took away from 4?
Yeah, and the main theme is obviously sexual abuse, but more so how consent is a part of sexual assault. That if there is not consent, then it's sexual assault, and that is can come in different forms. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think the last night's episode, for instance, kind of, there were two moments of people having realizations that something they didn't feel, like you said, that they knew wasn't okay, actually qualified as a crime. Mm-hmm. And that was, I don't know, I thought the ways that different characters have been treated when they deal with this has been illuminating and kind of tragic. Watching people process it themselves and how they choose to reveal information. I don't know, the big drama point from last night. I guess we'll get into spoilers.
Yeah, let's go ahead and spoil through episode 5. That's as far as we've seen, and probably anybody who's listening.
With her getting up and calling out a guy on stage that she is still in a consensual relationship with as recently as like the night before or that morning or whatever.
Seemed like it.
Yeah, very, very recently, and she's had this revelation that, she has been assaulted by him, and announcing that on stage. I mean, that was the big dramatic moment. But I thought that her friend, and I'm awful at names.
Terry, I think her name is.
Well, Terry, yes, who's been kind of a supportive, but a kind of a foil. I mean, they're always up to something funny. That's kind of one of the brilliant things about this show is that, even in these tragic moments, I'm laughing often because the characters are well written. The guy, what is the guy's name? I'm blanking.
The guy she calls out?
No, her friend who goes and meets another guy.
Oh,
and
it's spelled K-W-A-N-E, I think. I've seen that on the credits. So is it something like that?
Something like that. But needless to say, like his... You know, her choosing to reveal that assault or that rape at that very public reading compared to how he quietly goes to the police and tries to process it and is kind of given the cold shoulder by the cops. And if that's, I don't know if that's a, they were willing to not bend over backwards, but the process for her seemed very streamlined. And the statement that they're making about the way that a gay man may have to go through the legal system. I don't know. I thought that was very moving and obviously depressing.
And she had two female detectives, whereas he had this one guy detective, which I think was telling as well. And
well, he was just a cop too, right? He wasn't even a...
Yeah, they hadn't gotten to the detective process. He was just a cop. I think that was also a statement. And it mirrors, if you've seen that show, Unbelievable on Netflix. Did you ever get around to that one? Or I think you were on tour Mm-hmm. That's one of the biggest components of Unbelievable, how a female detective versus a male detective would handle a rape case. And that's based on a true story that happened in the West, out in Washington or in that area. But this one takes that a little bit further. This show, as I May Destroy You, takes that, and that's just part of the show. That's not one of the big,
right,
overarching right. facets. The show is looking at rape and sexual assault through many different prisms. Maybe even trying to tackle it in all its possible ways, because we do have her friend who is gay who got raped. and she has been drugged and raped. And then we get this new form of sexual assault in episode 4, where she is having consensual sex with a guy who takes off a condom unbeknownst to her. And she finds out that too is rape. So it's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot.
Like you said, these are motivating parts in terms of story. Like, they propel the story for sure, but they're not all of the story.
Right.
It's a very vibrant scene that's painted even after tragedy or in the midst of these tragic things that happen, to where, you know, I texted you. You said you asked if I had seen the latest episode after their Italy. Four. Yeah, their Italy adventure, which was just like, these girls are wild as hell, you know, and it still shows like that side of things in addition to trauma. So I don't know. I think we said this last time. It's, you know, she's this millennial influencer kind of person who is living a very interesting life in London and traveling to Italy and doing all these things. But, you know, even in last night's episode, is still having these intrusive flashbacks to deal with.
And then she also used the most recent episode, episode 5, to bring in the victim blaming part, right? With her on again, off again boyfriend from Italy, who says, if you'd just watched your drink, the first rape would have never happened. That's what they're referencing. If you just watched, and he keeps telling her that, like, he's angry at her because they're having to come swab him for DNA to make sure, you know, to eliminate him from the scene. Obviously, he didn't do it. It's not that kind of show, but not really a whodunit. No.
I thought it was going to go there in that first episode after.
Yeah,
she's out with that crew of dudes who we don't even really see again, or haven't seen so far. I don't know. I think, kind of like you said, that it's tackling sexual assault and rape and these topics, but doing a lot more heavy lifting. I think maybe one of the strengths is just that it throws all of this at us and doesn't really apologize about it. You know, it is a cross section of this life that's being lived, these lives that are being lived.
And still maintains a huge watchability factor. Like, huge, yeah. Like yeah. It's almost, I don't want to be too flippant, but it's quite bingeable. I remember after watching those first 2 episodes, because I let them pile up before we started doing the show, talking about the show. And I was just like, what happens next? I want to know more about Arabella and her life and friends. And it's going off in different directions, but I have a feeling it's going to reel itself back in and come back to some of those people we saw in episode 1 too.
Probably so. Yeah. And that, like I said, that it has its funny moments even in during its tragic moments. It's odd to say that a show with rape and assault kind of at its core is an enjoyable watch, but it largely is.
Yeah, it is. Heavy. Heavy
show. Very heavy, but they're funny people. They have these interesting lives. I don't know. I've been very impressed.
So, me too. It's a good show. It's on HBO. I think it airs on Monday night, but for those of you with HBO, catch up on it on demand or on the app or whatever. I do want to shift gears into, we don't cover music as much as I'd like sometimes, so I'm bringing this up just to see what you think, because I know you had listened to it, and I've been listening to it a lot. It's the new Phoebe Bridgers album, Punisher. I gave it a few really earnest listens. I know that you did as well. Tell me what you think about her new album.
I dig it. I think I haven't gotten to the level where I'm really piling through lyrics, but the way, you know, those first few listens, the way that she strings thoughts together that seem so kind of in the minutiae of a day-to-day life, you know, that's kind of what her biggest songs are, kind of like that. They already had been or seem to be, but it's almost conversational. I know it probably gets, and this isn't really fair, but kind of maybe lumped into like the confessional kind of songwriting world.
Like, does Courtney Barnett fall in that category for you?
No, not okay. I think I wouldn't put anybody in that category, because I think that's kind of a lazy descriptor, and one that's probably unfairly applied to women.
I got you. The reason why I asked is when you talked about diving into the minutia of a day, that reminds me a lot of Courtney Barnett, and I hadn't made that connection yet.
Yeah, it's definitely, and Courtney Barnett, they do it very differently, but it's a similar idea, maybe. I think the Phoebe Bridgers stuff is more heightened emotionally, or maybe that's the music. Maybe if you just read the words on a page, it would be similar. But I know she deals a little bit more in tragic circumstance, whereas, say, like, I think of a Courtney Barnett song like Depressed. You know, that's at its core, that is a sad song, but it doesn't necessarily sound that way. And it's kind of told in a, she lays out the shapes and you kind of fill in the blanks, if that makes sense. It's instead of just like directing your emotional flow through the song. I'll say about this record, without having really gotten to know it, definitely not on the level that I know those Courtney Barnett records, that it sonically, I'm really enjoying it. It sounds really good. I think there have been, you know, she's in the band Boy Genius with Julian Baker and I can't believe this. Oh, Lucy Dacus, who I'm a big fan of. I think that first record she did was very good. But to me, this is the most listenable of those, that trio of girls who often gets lumped together. I think that she maybe has the a bit more of a pop hook thing going on than Julian Baker does. And it just is more pleasing to listen to me.
One thing I noticed about her songwriting is she doesn't feel as married to rhyme as much as many other artists do. She will connect some lines that you wouldn't expect. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that lends to the me saying that it's kind of conversational in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you feel like you're kind of just walking around in her head while she's taking a walk or going to the drugstore, doing, you know, just doing normal everyday tasks and what's rattling around under the surface for all of us. Then you kind of, it's like she's pulling the curtain back on that for her own brain. I dig it.
Yeah, I do too. There's a line or two in there that reminds me of Sufjan Stevens type of writing, especially that line. I think it's early in the album where it says, "I haven't seen you since I was 17 or something like that. It kind of echoed some of that sadder Sufjan Stevens type of song.
Yeah. I think it's cool too that she is, I don't know exactly how old she is, but mid 20s, maybe going to late 20s, still fairly young. And at a, I feel like we don't, not a lot of songwriters get big when they're young like that anymore. And it's an interesting phase of life to hear well articulated. You know, she's still, maybe the, you said, haven't seen you since I was 17. Maybe her most famous song is about knowing a kid that has died and kind of processing that. Still being kind of connected to youthful feelings or the wounds of adolescence or any of these things, even though she's got that buffer of some adulthood to process it. I don't know. That's a different energy than, say, a lot of songwriters going into their 30s or whatever. Kind of it takes so long to like break, you know, I'm doing my air quotes, to break, that sometimes you lose that purity of energy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, she claims Elliott Smith as a huge influence, but I don't hear that as much, although that does make sense to me.
Yeah, I could hear that. And I can also, she's been working a lot with Conor Oberst, right?
Exactly. And I think he appears on the album with some background vocals.
Yeah.
You're a big fan of her Twitter feed, right?
She's funny. She's somebody that, do you have anybody that you don't follow because you let their tweets accumulate and then just read through them?
I don't think so.
She's definitely that person, because it's not like she's really weighing in on day-to-day events very often. So every now and again, I'll just go see, you know, what she was thinking about. Usually pretty funny.
Yeah.
Very witty.
So there you go. Phoebe Bridgers' album Punisher's been out for a couple weeks now. And I'll say that the vinyl is a gorgeous, all the work that went into making the art. It comes with a little booklet.
Great artwork.
Yeah, it comes with a little booklet. You and I are on a video feed. For those people listening, you and I are on a video feed. I thought about grabbing it and showing it to you. It's impressive. And the little book's full of artwork and the lyrics as well. And you were talking about reading the lyrics on the page. They work pretty well just on the page. I've enjoyed just picking up the artwork that goes with the album and just flipping through it. So good stuff from her. And it's pretty interesting that two of the major albums of the year so far has been Phoebe Bridgers' Punisher and Fiona Apple's release from March, I think it was.
Yeah, I think those are tough to argue that those shouldn't be top five by the end of the year unless something really monumental happens, but they're both great records.
And I don't want to pin them against each other, but my style leans toward Phoebe Bridgers. I really do like that album, I think. And it's the beauty of the album for me personally is that it benefits multiple listenings.
Yeah, it grows. I think that's...
And so does the Fiona Apple album.
Yeah, there's more unfolding all the time for me with the Fiona Apple record. But I agree that, kind of like I said, that like when the Courtney Barnett record came out, I guess it's been close to 5 years now. If it's not 5 years, that first one, I was so into that all summer. And it just got better and better the more you know, it's like an episode of Arrested Development or something. You know, like it's all the jokes are there. You can get a lot out of it on first viewing. But then once you understand themes that are happening and kind of end references and all these things, it just gets better and better the more that you watch or listen. I could totally see these being something like that.
So Punisher, that's a good album. I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it. Speaking of music, let's talk about Hamilton. You want to talk about Hamilton? Have you seen Hamilton, by the way?
No. And I know that pisses you off that I haven't seen it yet.
Have you? Everyone in the next month is going to ask you if you've seen Hamilton, okay? So just go watch it. Will you?
Why?
Well, I'm going to turn the tables for you. I'll let you play host to me having watched it because I've got some thoughts.
You got thoughts. All right, here, I'll paint everybody a picture. Blaine and I and our buddy Jeff texting on one evening this weekend.
Oh, it was Friday, day of release.
Day of release. Oh, you were you were waiting in the metaphorical line, the digital line, to see this thing. So he says, y'all, I'm watching this musical, this Hamilton thing.
An unbeknownst phenomenon.
Cultural. Let's give it its due because I feel like we're about to, two guys who don't really like musicals are about to bash this thing. And clearly I think we can agree that Broadway is maybe not a dominant cultural form in America most of the time. And for something to like capture the collective imagination like this from any kind of, it's not niche, but it's also not mainstream most of the time, Broadway. It's pretty amazing. I'm always amazed when these musicals do that.
It is amazing because it's captured everybody's attention, so many people's attention, without them having seen it.
Yeah. I mean, you can't just like get on YouTube and see what's going on.
It's purely from the music is what they're reacting to, I think. So yeah, go ahead.
But so he says, I'm going to watch this thing. Unbeknownst to me, Natalie had said, we'll get some takeout and hang. And I didn't realize that I was potentially being signed up to watch Hamilton. Fortunately, I got out of it. We ended up watching, I'll very briefly, before we get back to Hamilton, we'll plug a Netflix show that I have found endlessly enjoyable called Home Games. Where they just go around and do short, very well done short documentaries. I'm talking like 30-minute episodes about a sport that's being played in one area and nowhere else. So like the first one in Florence, Italy, they have basically a street brawl kind of game where you're just trying to advance a ball from one side to the other. But I mean, they're like punching each other in the face and it's insane. They do like the Highland Games, you know, where people are throwing logs and that kind of stuff. Anyway, great show. Had a fantastic Friday night. Meanwhile, you are in a 2 hour and 45 minute. Is that right?
2 hours, 40 minutes.
2 hours, 40 minutes. Musical experience. Tell me everything.
So I heard about this release a couple of days before it happened. I wasn't watching Twitter for Hamilton's release, but I did hear about it a couple of days before, and I thought, oh, okay. And then my wife was eager to watch it, very eager, and I thought, oh, okay, yeah, sure. I was open. I do not like musicals, and I'll get to that. I'm going to dissect that in a little bit.
I like history.
I like history, and this was the original cast. There's got to be something to it with the way that people explode about talking about it, especially online. So I said, I was really, really willing to give it a shot, to the point where in our group text, when you, I think you jabbed at me for watching it, or you made a really absurd jest about it. And I defended it.
People all day on Friday that it's just it's capitalist dribble.
Right.
Just
being really absurd. You were just absolutely off the cuff joking. And I stepped up and defended it. This is before I'd pushed play on the remote. And I was thinking, and I said, hey, this, you know, I'm going to give this a shot. This is supposedly good. Little did I know, there's not any dialogue in this play. It's all song/rapped.
You shouldn't be.
Did I not tell you this?
They don't talk?
No. It's straight singing or rapping. There are some songs. There's some moments where they're a little bit more on the singing than the rapping. But yeah, it's 100% musical. Like Les Mis is supposedly, which, yeah, don't. Never going to watch that. To the point where I was stoked that PBS released a Les Mis version that was all dialogue. I actually watched that and enjoyed it last year.
I've been led astray by Les Mis so many times, thinking like, are we getting a great Les Mis here? And then they just start singing, and I think, what the hell is wrong with people?
No, there's a good version from PBS last year that starred one of the main actors from The Wire. It was good. It had a great cast, actually. It had Olivia Cole in it. It was really good and touching and moving. Good. Even learned something about the French Revolution. But we're getting off track here because Hamilton's not about the French Revolution. It's a little bit more about the American Revolution. All right. What do you want to know? You said, tell me, what do you want to know? Because I'm primed, man. I'm primed.
We're going to keep this first question very short. Give me and you can use a plus or minus, but a letter grade on how you felt about Hamilton.
Just me. This is
just
me.
Just you. We have given it its due as a cultural artifact, right? No one can deny that. It has value. If we're being objective, we're not true art critics here. I'm asking for your opinion.
It's a C plus B minus, I think.
Wow, that's higher than I thought you were going to give it.
Well, I'm not sure if you're wanting me to grade it objectively or just from how I think about it.
From how you think about it.
Oh, D minus.
Oh, D minus. Okay.
Yeah. I'll never return to it.
Objectively, you're giving it a B minus?
Maybe even a B. Yeah.
So what, first let's talk about, you're not a musical fan.
Nope.
Not even a little.
Let me rattle off why, and I want to hear your thoughts on this too, because you're not either.
I'm not. I can't articulate why I'm not.
Here's why, not why. I'm going to get into why. You dislike musicals more so than I think. And I'm going to, and you may agree with me or not on that. So most musicals, and I've sat through a lot. You may be sitting there thinking, yeah, but you've never watched it. No. I watch, I sit through at least one or two musicals a year. Okay. And that's, I won't get into why or how. I just do. Trust me. Like physical plays, musicals. Well done ones. Okay. So, but here's the thing. They have horrible songs. And what I've found is that most of the times their melodies are very non-existent or they sound like they're made up on the fly. Does that reverberate with you?
I think so.
Like they'll be trying to express an emotion or the character needs to express a certain part of his or her mental state. And it's just all of a sudden I'm going to start doing this. You know, it's like, it sounds made up on the fly.
Yeah.
Musicals sound like somebody trying to sing a musical. Does that make sense?
Yes. Musicals sound like someone trying to do a musical.
In real time.
Yeah. No, that makes sense to me. I think the only musical I'll stand up for is, you remember that episode of Futurama where Fry learns how to play that instrument that can create visuals? That's a pretty good musical.
Okay. Does that count?
No, I don't think so. I just always think of the robot devil coming up and saying, your characters can't say how they feel. That makes me feel angry. Mm-hmm. And that's often how I feel about a musical.
Well, and we might have to split hairs here and decide what's a musical and what's a movie-cool. Is that a term? Didn't Jeff use that term recently?
Movie-cool.
Yeah, okay, it's like, so like a movie that's it's like a, it was, it started as a movie and ended as a movie. Like, it's not a play.
So there's a, there's definitely a spectrum for the movie, right? So like, let's just, I'm only thinking of Beatles examples right now. The movie Across the Universe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's, isn't Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory a musical, though, only exactly a movie?
Yeah. So you have two movies where music is a pretty important factor.
They'll break into song.
Right? Yeah. Are you a Willy Wonka fan? Are you a fan of the original?
Very, very big fan.
I'm a huge fan.
Yeah. So there, is that a musical? Does that count? Or are we talking specifically musicals as plays? So, you know.
I don't. So the music in Willy Wonka is, if you took it away, I wouldn't like that movie as much.
Me either. Me either. That's Gene great. Wilder singing those songs is fantastic, and the other actors do a pretty good job too. So yeah. Most musicals have shit songs, okay? And I'll give you an example. There's this play called Aida, and its music was written by the Elton John, and it sucks so bad. The song.
Go find his demos that never made it and write the songs.
No idea. I don't think he wrote the words, but so maybe it's on the person who wrote the words that didn't find the right melody. But they're bad. Like you can't. I don't know. Okay. So that's one of the big reasons. So the songs are also bad because they're so hamstrung by having to tell a narrative. Usually,
yeah.
You know what I mean. They're having to express something important, I think.
Do you feel like on this topic, so this is like a moment in history that is so endlessly mineable for interesting stories. And I guess you could say these are not, this is kind of like the B team of founding fathers or mm-hmm. of that era. Mm-hmm. You know, these are not like the first guys that you learn in elementary school, say, which is a whole other topic to discuss in 2020, but do you feel like you learned anything?
Yeah, I do a little.
I mean, obviously you're gonna, with any movie, if you watch like a historic drama or something like that, or, you know, you're gonna fact check and kind of use it as a jumping off point. But given that, do you feel like it was, you were, anything was illuminated for you?
So because Hamilton bored me quite a bit, I ended up spending some time on my phone learning the real thing.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, I did learn. Hard to say whether Hamilton did that or not.
Now, Hamilton himself was kind of a dick, right?
Yes.
Was he portrayed as that? I've seen that be kind of a point of, you know, this is obviously kind of like maybe overly dismissive the other way, but a tweet saying, well, he fled like revolutions in the Caribbean and came to North America because it wasn't quite as hot, so to speak, slave revolutions, I should say. And he came up here because it was a little calmer and intentionally married into this wealthy New York City family, made a ton of money off the slave trade. He's a complicated guy, not a great guy.
Some of that's definitely touched on, and one of the big things that kind of makes him a rascal in the play is he has an eye for his sister-in-law, and that kind of sort of plays out somewhat on screen, on the stage. Yeah, but back to general musicals, I want to make one more point.
We're back.
Here's another problem, and you tell me if this is one of your problems with musicals, is that each song... and especially with Hamilton, this was true. Each song felt like it had to reach some kind of crescendo.
Ooh, yeah.
So that they're so exhausting after, after, you know, four or five, it's like, oh God, I'd, you know, that one was supposed to emotionally take me higher than the previous one. And I get that concerts need to do that same bit of business, but to me, that's less exhausting because there's a lot more to concentrate on. Like, you can zone out to the drummer or the guitar player or the lyrics or whatever. And with a musical, it's just lyrics or performance. It's one or two, really. And maybe the set, if the set's done. Yeah.
Well, you know, crafting a set of songs, not a physical set, but say making a set list for a band, that's an art form.
I agree.
Not for everybody. So they didn't do it well.
For him? Well, you know, yeah. Everything's sung. Everything's got to be bigger and better, or it felt like it had to be.
That's an interesting phenomenon. It's like like in church, you know, they'll employ like a key change at the end of the song to kind of get your motor revving. So they're just trying to do this the whole time. You can't. That sounds exhausting.
It's utterly exhausting. They did have some low moments. Low. That's not the right word. It did have some more quieter songs.
Mm, some ballads.
Yeah, it did.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And also with plays in general, you don't get to chance. I love plays, by the way, but with musicals, plays, you never get a chance to see a lot of the show don't tell style of acting, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I can give you a specific moment in Hamilton where this bugged me. It's pretty early. He's singing about his parents and their death, and that could be this fascinating moment of emotional resonance or even ambiguity where you don't know if he's resentful of this moment or if he's lonely or if he's sad or whatever. And that's the kind of stuff you can see in a movie or show with their eyes, their expression, their stature, anything. But there's just no time for him to linger on that because he's having to rap the next line or sing the next line.
Mm.
And
he's pulled along the pace.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny that a podcast that spent weeks praising normal people where they barely talk is not a fan of a musical. This makes perfect sense.
Well, it should come as no surprise.
Yeah.
So there's no time to linger. And with musicals in general, sometimes there is. And many of them have dialogue outside of the songs, but for me, a lot of times I'll get into the dialogue and thinking about the weight of that, and then they'll just start singing again, and so I'm sucked right out.
You're telling me, I can't get over this. No one mm-hmm. spoke a single word the entire time.
Not one damn word.
Damn. Now, riddle me this.
Our audience is gone, man. They have, yeah.
Yeah. Did he get shot on screen?
Yes, he did.
Was that satisfying to you?
Now, that moment had some resonance. There was some sadness because his wife got an opportunity to express in song how that affected her. And that actually felt like a good musical moment.
That's a time for a song. If you're sure. going to be a song kind of production, I agree.
And of course, no one really sings their emotions in real life, at least not day to day. So, you know.
It's not anybody I want to hang out with.
Not unless they're sitting down and planning to do so with like a guitar or keyboard or drums or whatever. So anyway, Hamilton was boring for all those reasons. But there's one more, and I saw this on, I think, a Reddit thread. So I forgive for stealing this, or I hope I'm forgiven for stealing this. There, it feels like Lin-Manuel Miranda got stuck in 1994 hip-hop and really just didn't go much further than that.
Mm, interesting. So there's even like some style. I didn't even think about that. The having rap involved in a Broadway production feels a bit like, hey, I know what we should do. We have this rock song. Let's rap the fourth verse or get a guy to come in. Does it kind of feel like that kind of?
100%.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and the set is not... It's not ornate. There's not a lot going on with the set design. They do have this revolving floor, which was
the Lazy Susan approach.
The Lazy Susan. Yeah. How'd you know? Have you seen this?
I have been told that.
Yeah, I do that. That was kind of interesting. But other than that, it was, I don't know.
I got to be honest. The Lazy Susan, and when I asked earlier if he dies on screen, I knew that some bitch died on screen. Those are the two things I know about this production.
Oh, well. Yeah. So thumbs down, Hamilton.
Two thumbs down to Hamilton and the whole concept of musicals.
Hey, I'm open. I went into this thing open, but I got about 45 minutes into it and was like, where's my phone? Hand me my phone.
I'm kind of with you. I was not dismissive of this outright, though I had a feeling it probably wouldn't be for me. But I thought, you know, I like history. I like stuff. I like understanding what's happening in the world culturally. So maybe I'll watch it, but I'm not sure that I will now.
There's a lot of good think pieces related to how it's a product of the Obama era versus the Trump era, which I think is an interesting concept to consider, but that means you have to sit through the play.
I'll just read the think piece.
Just read the think pieces. Or just read a book about Hamilton or an article.
I'll burn out Wikipedia.
Yeah, do like I did. Yeah, so there you go. If you're still with us. God bless you. We're going to take a quick break, though. We're going to get back into the show in a second. Okay, thanks once again for listening. We'll get back into the show, and we'll talk about the captivating documentary Jasper Mall, available to rent on Amazon and other video-on-demand formats. Before we do, just a quick reminder that there is even more to read on the website, even more to find out, which is thealabamatake.com. Corey Hanna, who hosts the interview podcast simply called The Alabama Take, has alluded on his personal social media pages that the original podcast is going to be coming back for season 3. No date's been set for that. In the meantime, you can find it and subscribe and catch up to The Alabama Take, the original podcast. If you haven't, subscribe to us. We are taking it down. Okay, let's jump back into things. Okay, welcome back from the break. Adam and I are going to break down our thoughts on, we're going to be taking it down, if you will, our thoughts on this new documentary that's appeared on video on demand. I think you can rent it almost anywhere, but I watched it on Amazon. I paid the $4.99 to rent it on the 4th of July. How about that?
Same here. Well worth it. I'll just say at the outset, money well spent.
You even went to your band page, Speckled Bird, by the way, little name drop there, Speckled Bird band page, to praise this documentary. And I'm going to let you kick things off because you hailed it pretty glowingly.
Yeah, I think my motivation for going to the band page to do that is, you know, to lift up other people in Alabama that are trying to do cool things. One of the things that really impressed me about this was that it took a departure from, you know, there's almost this like, I know I'm going to stumble saying this word, fetishization. That's a tough one to say. People fetishize small town stuff. It's very, like, if you wanted to make that documentary, there is a very easy, cut and dry, paint by numbers way to do it. And they didn't do it. They refused to do it. It had its own rhythm. It had a style. It was, I don't know. There were so many, like, I would have been impressed by that even if I had no idea where Jasper was. You know, it worked on a very deep level to me.
And we'll talk about that rhythm. That's one of the things I definitely want to talk about was, well, before we talk about rhythm, one thing I want to get out of the way was we need to credit the filmmakers here, like you were talking about. So this was directed by Brad Thomason, excuse me, and Brett Whitcomb.
Whitcomb.
Oh, man. Yeah. We are probably butchered their poor names. Sorry, guys. And these guys are Alabama artists, right? Alabama filmmakers.
And pretty big crew worked on this thing, and just a lot of Alabama folks were involved.
Okay. Do you know if they are specifically Alabamian?
I don't.
Yeah, me either. We should get them on the show.
That would be great. I would love to. I have questions.
Okay, so what do you have? Just in case they do come on, we don't want to spoil too much, but give me a question that you would have about this.
Well, I'd say from a structural standpoint, they made a decision to never have anyone formally interviewed.
That's true. Yes, that is so true. And it worked.
And it worked so, so well. You know, there are documentaries who you never hear the interviewer's voice. And that's the decision. And then sometimes the interviewer is like part of the documentary. This one, there was never a moment. I mean, clearly they had people sit down or maybe they found them where they were and started asking them questions. But it wasn't like, or it didn't seem to be like, we're going to light this corner of this empty room and ask you these questions. It was way more organic than that. And that's like kind of when I said that they were doing things with their own style. That's kind of what I'm talking about.
And even like didn't follow them home. Like a lot of documentaries would follow these people home and give you more of their story. But this was a story specifically centered around the mall.
Right. And it, you know, say the security guard, there's a million questions you could ask about him.
Oh my God. I've got so many.
What does home look like? Where's he from? We'll just get it out of the way. You and I could not figure out his accent.
He slipped into Australian accent, into Southern accent, into like this Midwestern neutral accent.
Yeah.
That's baffling, but in a good way.
But I'm with you that, you know, it feels in the wrong hands, it would feel reductive to only have folks when they're at the mall. You know, mm-hmm. if they're employees of the mall, if they own a business in the mall, if they play dominoes all the time at the mall, you'd think like, well, we're only getting one version of this person, but I don't know. There was something haunting about that decision. When the whole thing is really a study on the demise of this certain version of American commercialism.
I would go so far as to say that the documentary ends up being a study on demise in general, overall.
Yeah, I agree. Because you see cycles of life happen. I thought it's slow introduction of, you know, when I saw the trailer and it was the security guard and he was watering the plants in the mall, I'm like, this, okay, they're going for kind of like bummer porn, you know, like this kind of be sad and it's all under this fluorescent glow and blah, blah, blah. But it wasn't that at all. You know, it had clips of him and you're kind of learning his story. He's kind of like the through line, right?
Yeah.
Kind of you're explaining everything. You had a younger guy applying for a job with him. You had the florists are retiring and getting out of there. You had the mm-hmm. older guys that play dominoes. One of them passed away. You also have this young couple that is about to graduate high school and just starting out in life. So they did a really good job of balancing all of these different moments, I guess. And like you said, it's about demise in a lot of ways. And it tied in. So you didn't even see the rest of, not only did you not see when these people went home, you didn't see the rest of Jasper. You know, it is reduced just to this one physical space.
And it stood in for the demise of small town, the demise of, how lucky did they get to have these cast of characters, so to speak? They're not characters, but this wonderful set of people who represented the end of things. We've got the high school relationship that dissolves, that lady's retirement, which fits a physical death of one of the members of the Domino Club. You know, this is definitely a movie about death. Small towns dying, malls dying, relationships that flourish in communities that, you know, like a mall, a community of a mall, because that is definitely a community where relationships happen. I think you and I both still recall the age of going to a mall, right?
Yeah, it's funny. I get 2 points to what you said. The first, when they're on the roof at one point and our security guard is kind of surveying everything and he says, we got to figure out how to get people to the mall. And he said the town is very proud of downtown and wants to revitalize that area. And he said, I think that's great, but we got to save this mall too. And that just set up such a, I've been to Jasper. I've seen these efforts to, we did a documentary on the Bankhead family when I worked at UA. And they're from Jasper. So I even had like a favorite restaurant downtown. I've seen these efforts that are kind of going on across the South and across the nation to kind of get Main Street going again, right? And Main Street went to the mall before. And so it's this tug of war. It's just funny to see somebody stand up for a mall. You never hear the guy that wants to stand up for the mall in those situations because, you know, that's like the depressing past. That's an empty parking lot that maybe is not really connected to your community. But this documentary says, no, these are community members. This does impact people around you. And to your second point, I definitely grew up with some of that culture swirling around. And I laughed that I've called the whole thing a fever dream a few times. And when they were showing old pictures, I almost thought like, well, you know, sometimes I wonder was my things from my childhood seem kind of like the mall idea seems kind of ridiculous. Did that, was it actually as like Technicolor and strange as I remember it? And they're showing those old pictures and I'm like, yeah, it was a weird chapter in American cultural history. And just to tie all this together, thought it was very funny that 4th of July last year, we started Stranger Things. And the last season was about, it came out on the 4th of July. It's based in that mall that, and we talked about this on the early days of this show. That
first episode.
Yeah, that was it. But we talked about that age of the mall and kind of, you're older than me, so you maybe you remember it more into adolescence than I do. But, you know, the wonder of the mall, and that's where you went and all these things. And to contrast that with, you know, obviously we know what's going to happen to that mall in that show if it survives until 2020. But to contrast that with this documentary of the real world and kind of where that culture went, I don't know, I thought that was a funny bookend.
Right. And I remember the mall. We would have to travel about 45 minutes to the nearest mall and about 55 to an hour to another one. Totally different one, more new, you know, a more new experience. So there was one in Columbus, Mississippi, that was the nearest. And then there was one in Tupelo, Mississippi, which was a newer mall and more neon, you know. And that has a huge impact on me as a kid because I would go to the record store in the mall. I would go to the bookstore in the mall. I can't tell you how many times I picked up Stephen King paperbacks and flipped through them and thought, is this the one I'm going to read next? Is this the one I'm going to buy? And it's all so clear. So does that pepper my viewing of this, you know, because it's crushing. This documentary is pretty crushing to see. And at the same time, it's just capitalism. The mall is just a symbol for capitalism, but these aren't mom and pop shops that are closing. You know what I mean? Like the JCPenney, the Kmart, they were huge stores, huge conglomerates at one time. And so what is it about seeing them empty is a little rattling? Is it my childhood? Is it just the end of things in general is a little rattling? Is it a reminder of mortality, you know?
Yeah, and you wonder, obviously a lot of those companies close because of national problems, but you know, if you think about when he's walking around the JCPenney, like how many people had a first job there? How many people that was like you saved up and went there and got whatever you needed, all these things that represented something to people in that community. And you wonder, on the national scale, those companies were going away either way. But it does ask questions about if a community can support those things anymore, what that means if they can't, or if they're choosing to support something else. I'm with you. He stands in the Kmart at that customer service island, and he seems like impressed by it. Our security guard again, is who I'm talking about. He said, yeah, we could open up and use this again right now. Like, that was such a depressing moment. You know, you wonder, like, it's just stuck in this time warp. And I guess if you are living that time warp every day, you don't understand what's forwards and what's backwards.
Right. And the emptiness of that JCPenney, he doesn't go into it, but it's shown from the outside. It just tapped into my familial memories. We went every August to JCPenney to buy back to school clothes. It never failed up until a certain point. And I think it's just a reminder that, you know, of death in a wide swath.
Yeah, all those things are, when those buildings close or get knocked down or whatever, you know, they're put into a past that you can't, you know, you can go back to, say, a downtown or something like that, and it has some of the same vibe, but these buildings that would have been so impressive at first. I mean, even just they're walking around in the different, you know, steps and levels and fountains and plants and all these things. These were built to impress people. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of a depressing holdout from this time that doesn't exist anymore.
These people were treated very gently by the filmmakers, as far as when they took their footage and made the film into a documentary. You were commenting, and we started the talk actually briefly about the rhythm of the movie. What did you think about the rhythm of it?
You know, I wondered at first if it was going to have, if it was going to be kind of just these little vignettes as it went along.
Mm-hmm.
But there were arcs, like traditional kind of story arcs that happened, and it was, you know, they treated the characters gently, but they also treated the movement of the stories in a really gentle way. I thought it was great. I thought it was the decision for them not to to be on camera asking questions, for all of these subjects to kind of exist on their own. They didn't belittle anyone. Mm-hmm. They treated them with respect.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was very moving, and I'm impressed that people were as... At first, it seemed to kind of split into two camps of, like, we have to save them all. It never really, like, there were no rallies or organization meetings or anything like that, but wishing for something that is not going to come back to come back. And then a few people, like the jeweler, for example, early on, just facing the brutality of numbers and saying, I made $16 one day last week. I can't stay here. I got to go. Now, you wonder, if he sets up shop somewhere else, is he going to do much better? But I don't know, that him saying there's just no foot traffic in here anymore. It was, you know, all of these things. It sounds like a depressing movie, but it wasn't a depressing movie. I mean, it was, but I didn't walk away just feeling like totally bummed out.
No.
And I think that's a credit to how well they treated the subjects.
I'm always in love with art that takes one thing to examine and uses it as a lens to examine a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah.
Which I feel like this film did well.
Especially when they don't really directly talk about it. They just kind of let it unfold. And that was a strength of this one. That's when I led off and said, I would appreciate this anywhere, but the fact that it came from Alabama, it's about Alabama, and it made a stylistic statement. Like, it wasn't just functional. They made decisions that were interesting and made for a very compelling documentary. Like, I'm not just championing this because it's from here. I would champion this from anywhere.
Me either. I have no qualms about bashing something from around here if it's not any good. Although that's usually not our forte. Hamilton wasn't made in Alabama.
No.
This documentary sits in direct contrast to the Netflix documentary Tiger King, I think. Because that used, and you mentioned this, that it's, you kind of strayed away from it because it felt as if it was going to use its, the people of it, as oddities.
Yeah, I get really, especially in regards to the South, that's a very tiresome trope to me. You know, look how weird these people are, that kind of thing.
And you're right. This could have steered into that if it wanted. I don't know that these people were that weird, but it could have.
It definitely could have. I mean, the security guys, literally, I thought about the Tiger King comparison. I mean, he owned tigers. He ran a zoo.
Yeah, it was there.
And that they didn't do that, and that there was even some moral ambiguity in some of the moments, like where he talks about, well, protesters came and didn't like the animals being caged. And then I said some things that I shouldn't have said and lost my zoo. This is a guy who, and there's a whole backstory there that would have probably made for more page turner kind of viewing that mm-hmm. they didn't indulge. And I really, really appreciated that you got him where he is now. He alludes to this past. It clearly upsets him. And it's, you know, it's up to us. It felt much more lifelike, I guess, in that way.
How many hours a day did he spend there, do you think?
You know, I tried to figure out that they show him at first kind of describing the opening and then the lockup routine for the mall. Is he there for both of them?
And how many days a week? Because it's 7 days a week.
Yeah. This guy just doesn't seem to take a break from the mall.
I did try to figure out what they were blending seasons there to tell their narrative, obviously. I was trying to figure out, sometimes he said it was cold, and then other times it was obviously in the summer or spring because of the foliage in the on the trees in the background.
Yeah, I assumed that, well, it's definitely football season during some of the shots. We have the visual cues to know that when everybody's wearing their Bama gear, You know, I think they were actually there on a game Saturday for one of them. Natalie pointed that out very astutely. But, you know, the young high school couple who goes to the fair, that seems to be like a fall semester kind of thing or early spring. And then they graduate, they go through a Christmas, a full year there, right?
Yeah, I think they had to. There's a person on IMDb who reviewed this with one star. What a ridiculous thing. But okay. Saying this is such a joke. The movie is really about a bunch of people with no lives who are wondering what will happen to them when the shopping mall closes down. There's some misplaced sentimentality and obvious rehearsals and camcard readings by supposedly regular people. It's a strange mess. That is not the reading I had of this movie at all.
It's funny that this person, this one-star reviewer, would say something like, there are obvious rehearsals and camcard readings by supposedly regular people. It's just a strange mess. Like, when expressing that, is a really, like, assuming that they have rehearsed the things that they've said. One, I don't think this reviewer has been to the South and heard how people can really get going when they talk.
Mm-hmm.
But it also is a judgment clearly on their intelligence, you know, like why they would still be there, this reviewer is making a judgment on the intelligence of the people in the movie, I think. And I think what the movie asks you to do is to consider that these are good people, smart individuals who this is life, you know? I think the conversation between the hairdresser and her friend fairly early on when they talk about getting out of Jasper, that idea of getting out, you know, there were moments that it almost reminded me of like a Tom Petty song. But if the, say like even like a Last Dance with Mary Jane or like any of these were like, the goal is to get out, right? Of wherever Southern or Midwestern thing, there's got to be something somewhere out there better than this.
Mm-hmm.
And these folks never chased it. It's kind of like the, what if they didn't quite have the gumption or whatever to like, or life didn't let them get out of that little small town. And what does that say about them? You know, and I just, the one star reviewer seems to think they're just not that bright or they're just not, you know, but I think it's, we all know they live in the South. It's a lot more complex than that.
And there's also this bit that for the longest, there was no reason to leave. You know?
Yeah. I think the florist couple that send the arrangements out, I mean, they get pretty literal when she's describing the work that she used to do, you know, a lot of weddings, birthdays, all these kind of things. And now it seems like funerals kind of keep her in business. Mm-hmm. And that's a sad fact, but for them to be reaching retirement age and have these memories of what the mall was, you know, she's the one with the big binder of clippings and pictures and all this stuff. It's almost like them looking back at their younger selves, and it was a more exciting time, all this, but it's not in their heads. It's real.
It's a very moving piece of work, I think, if you allow it to kind of wash over you. Is there anything in there that didn't work for you?
No, I thought it was all great. I thought there were only a few times that it seemed like somebody was kind of playing for the camera. Like the younger couple seemed a little bit like they were camera aware.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I liked, like after their last discussion, which seemed, you know, that was the only time I wondered, like, did the filmmakers ask them to come to the mall one last time after doing some follow-up questions?
Yeah, and that I was going to bring it up, that was the only scene that didn't quite hit for me, although they had a moment outside the doors that did.
Yeah, when they go outside and they kind of watch through the doors, I thought that was a good conclusion to that, because that was authentic, you know. No, I thought it was all great. Also, a shout out to the music in it that I thought did such a great job. A lot of it came from a label in Birmingham called Earth Libraries. It's been doing a lot of really cool stuff. And it was actually, a bunch of that was mastered by my buddy and bandmate, Jamie Seago, over at Portside Sound in Sheffield. So when I fired up the movie, it clicked. I was like, oh, Jamie worked on this, kind of. Mm-hmm. He worked on a part of it that became the soundtrack. So
mm-hmm.
I thought that was really good. I thought the, you know, musically to me almost felt like I was watching like an extended Beach House music video or something like that. It just lived in that kind of like, again, I'm going to overuse this phrase, but like fever dreamish kind of vaporwave, chill wave kind of world.
The score had a little bit of a Daniel Lanois feel to it as well.
It did. Yeah, just kind of spacey, kind of atmospheric stuff.
Bryant Saxton, also is credited as his executive producer, whom I know. I used to know him in my Tuscaloosa days. He was active in the music scene there. It's just a stellar documentary. You want to comment on the jeweler playing guitar on his last day?
What was he trying? Was he just letting it go? You think that was his last day?
I hope it was. I hope he was just saying, fuck it, I'm going to set up my amp and I'm going to play some riffs.
I didn't know if maybe that was like, nobody's coming in here, I'm going to try to get somebody to come in here. I don't know. It had he had the amp with the onboard effects going.
Mm-hmm.
Oof.
Tell me your thoughts on the gospel singing
moment. So when that dude started singing bass, I was just like fist pumping in the air. Like, this is so great. And that's another thing that, you know, people who just shit on a small town, and then you see people get up that, you know, all those people have quote unquote normal jobs. Probably they're just like people who do this on the side. And that was I have a feeling that gathering probably punched above its weight in terms of talent, even if they're playing music that wasn't necessarily my bag the whole time. I was impressed that they put that. It was kind of like a sad idea, like, oh, we'll get some people in for the gospel and they'll, you know, listen to some music and then go shop and then stop back by. And but I definitely, one of the first times I was really around bluegrass was at a mall. I distinctly remember that as a kid. They had like some gathering at the I guess it would have been the McFarland Skyland Mall in Tuscaloosa, out there where they would do the Kip Tyner show. But I just remember, you know, mandolin and banjo and all these instruments that I never heard guitar played that way either, just out there shredding. So, you know, but that was also a long time ago. That wasn't 2018, 19, whenever they shot this.
This is how my mind works. When they showed that scene, I did comment on the guy's voice to my wife, but I also ran numbers in my mind thinking, okay, how much did the mall spend for this? How much are they getting paid individually? And, you know, this is like a Saturday gig and they go to work Monday through Friday. And, you know,
you think they got paid? I got the impression that it was just like they invited different church groups to come in. You think these were like bands that got paid?
I think those singing groups get paid. Yeah. I think they go to churches and places like that, and they, in a church situation, they would take up a donation and they'd take that money. And in that situation, I bet they got $40 a piece, $50 a piece.
Pretty good.
For an hour on Saturday, yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
Anyway, the documentary is just called Jasper Mall. You can find it online. And just it's 89 minutes long, 88 minutes. Just sit back and let it wash over you.
I thought it was great.
It's a good piece of art. I thought it was very well done, very artful.
Yeah, I would calling it a piece of art, calling it artful, that's the way to do it, instead of just saying it was a good documentary, because it was a lot more than that to me.
I agree. All right, that's the end of this episode of Taking It Down. We're going to be back next Tuesday with another show. We're going to keep it weekly for the next little while. We'll try to post an announcement online just on what we'll be covering on. So follow us on social media so that you can kind of stay up to date with us and stay abreast of our discussions to come. Folks, we'll talk to you later.